Good afternoon. Thanks for coming. This is Building Robust, Maintainable, Coded UI Tests with Visual Studio 2010. I'm trying to go for the longest title here. So how many people are brand new to Coded UI Tests? Okay, quite a few of you. So this is pitched as a 300-level talk, but we're going to start from the beginning. And so we're going to start by building a coded UI test from the ground up. And really my goal here is to show you some techniques that I've learned along the way to really build these tests in such a way that they're robust, meaning that they're going to give you the right bug reports. They're not going to generate false positives, and they're not going to generate or not fire if you have a bug in your software. So that's what we mean by robust. And they're also maintainable as well. So as your application grows and evolves over time and you need to maintain the tests in your coded UI test suite, we want to make sure that we can do so with as little effort as possible. The sample application that we're going to be building a test for today is actually very, very basic. It's a Hello World WPF application. And so I chose to start with that application type because really the devil is in the details when it comes to understanding the coded UI testing framework and everything that goes around that. So rather than complicate the scenario by looking at a really complicated app and then building a coded UI test for that, we're just going to start with really basic application and then build on top of that. So my name is Brian Keller. I work at Microsoft. I'm a technical evangelist for Visual Studio Application Lifecycle Management. I've been at Microsoft for about 9 years and have worked in one way or another attached to Visual Studio. For the last 3 years, I focused on our application lifecycle management tooling. I'm also on Channel 9 every week. My blog contains pretty much every presentation that I give. So I was here at Dev Days last year, and I gave a couple of presentations, kind of the 200-level introduction on our manual testing story and our automated testing story. Those are all recorded, so you can check those out online. If you haven't seen what we've done for software testers kind of more generally in the 2010 product line, I would encourage you to familiarize yourself with that. And also my virtual machine is available for you to download as well. So I maintain a series of virtual machines that have Team Foundation Server and sample applications, and almost everything that I demonstrate in my public talks is available for you to download as a virtual machine. And I take the time to actually script out all of my demos as well. So if you wanted to go back and do the same demos that you'll see me do, you could do that as well. There's a few seats up front if you guys want to head up here. I've written a couple of books. The one on the left is really mainly positioned at the breadth overview of everything that we did in 2010 related to team software development. So whether you're an architect or a Team Foundation Server administrator, a developer or a tester, there should be something in there for everybody. And then the one on the right just came out, and that's actually focused on everything you need to know about setting up and maintaining a Team Foundation Server instance. So if you're the guy in charge with maintaining your Team Foundation Server, or if you're just someone who's in charge of figuring out a complicated branching and merging strategy, there should be something in there for everyone. So the objectives of today's session, as I mentioned, we want to build robust and maintainable coded UI tests. That really boils down to three things for me. Number one, we want to increase the number of legitimate bugs that we find. And so a lot of the time, the reason that you switch to coded UI tests is because you don't always have time to manually test everything. And of course, we want to build up our regression tests over time so that we can make some changes to code, fire it at our build engine, and then get back either immediately or overnight a list of any features that we broke, right? That's the whole idea of building automated tests. That's why we're doing this in the first place. We want to reduce the number of false positives. You know, it's the broken window syndrome. If you start taking a look at your build reports every day and they've got hundreds of tests that are failing and you just kind of know the tests are broken, pretty soon your tests are going to start to give you some really interesting bugs and you're going to ignore them because, well, it's just lost in the noise of everything else that's going on. So we want to really reduce those false positives if we can. There's still some seats up here if you guys want. And then, of course, we want to reduce the effort, both in terms of the effort required to manually test your applications, the effort required to build these automated tests, and, of course, if you do them in a smart manner, you can reduce the amount of time and effort it takes to maintain those manual tests over time or those automated tests over time. So what do you need to start working with coded UI tests? Well, coded UI tests are a new test type that show up in either Visual Studio 2010 Premium or Visual Studio 2010 Ultimate. You can run these tests just from the command line, but in order to get the nitty-gritty tooling that we provide to help you actually generate these tests, you should be using Premium or Ultimate to do that. I highly recommend getting Feature Pack 2 of Visual Studio 2010. So if you have Visual Studio with an MSDN subscription, you can log into your MSDN subscription to download all of the feature packs we've published to date. Today there's three of them. And Feature Pack 2 actually introduces the capabilities which enhance the coded UI test experience with a graphical editor that I'll be showing in my demonstration. It also adds support for creating test automation that can record and playback Firefox events, and it also adds support for Silverlight 4. Actually, let me amend that statement. When you record your browser tests, you're recording within Internet Explorer, and you can play those back in Firefox. So that's how we've implemented that. You will need C# or Visual Basic skills in order to work with coded UI tests. The reason I mention that is there are a lot of test automation solutions out there. Some of them are more addressable by manual testers who may be more comfortable with basic scripting skills. Coded UI tests are not one of those. So I don't try to sell these to a manual tester who isn't willing to dive into the code and sort of learn how C# and Visual Basic works. Now, with that said, when you're writing coded UI tests, you get, of course, full access to the .NET framework. And I think there's a lot more interesting things you can do with coded UI tests that you may not be able to do in some of the other frameworks. But I do try to make that clear that this is not a scripting solution like some of the other ones that are out there. And then optionally, you can get Microsoft Test Manager for your team. Microsoft Test Manager is our new manual testing solution. The reason I mention that in the context of a test automation talk is you can actually create and record your manual tests as you're going through those, and those can become the basis for creating fully automated coded UI tests as well. And I'll show you how that works. Specifically, I'll show you some tips that as you're going through that workflow, it'll make it much easier to take the tests that your manual testers are creating and hand those off to your developers who are going to be creating those fully automated coded UI tests. And then finally, of course, we need to have a testable application. Our coded UI testing framework is very dependent on the type of application that you're testing with. Now, I know this is an eye chart slide that I'm about to show you, so I don't expect you to read this. I'll try to go through it. The things at the top of the list are the things that are either fully supported or very close to being fully supported. So we have really good support for recording and playing back web applications. We don't care if you're writing ASP.NET, Java, PHP applications on the back end. All we care about is that it's operating within the context of the browser, and our tests record and playback at the DOM layer. And so if you are using Internet Explorer, that might be different than Firefox because the DOM sometimes gets rendered differently. So that's why we give you that additional support there so you can at least test in a couple of different browsers. But for the most part, what's going on in the back end, including JavaScript, API, you know, AJAX calls that you may be making, that's all okay. That's not a problem for us. Next couple on the list here are rich client applications, so Windows Forms, WPF applications, we have full support for those. SharePoint 2007 and 2010 applications, you can record coded UI tests with those. There are some gotchas with SharePoint applications, some best practices you need to be aware of. We're not covering that today, but if you download my slide deck, there's actually links off of this slide to a few of these. So follow the blog post if you're creating SharePoint applications, and it'll give you some tips there. Firefox, as I mentioned, Feature Pack 2 adds support for that. Silverlight, we support Silverlight 4 in-browser applications as a Feature Pack 2. And then as you get further down the list, the level of support that we have starts to degrade. So Win32 applications, your mileage may vary. Just kind of depends on what type of applications they are. Whether or not you're making heavy use of COM components can oftentimes determine whether or not we can play back those tests. Dynamics AX applications are partially supported right now, and MFC applications the same. Where you get further down the list, this is an opportunity that we could see support over time from partners that may want to create additional extensibility for our platform. So a good example would be Flash or traditional Java applications like Swing applications. There's not currently extensible packs that can provide that support, but there is the possibility to create extensibility support and extend our application over time. Okay? So with that, let's get out of PowerPoint and jump into some demonstration here. So I mentioned that we're going to be starting with the world's simplest application. So I just have a WPF test application here. I've got a text box, hello world, go. And then what it should do is it should populate this label with the text that we just created. So let's say that I'm done writing manual tests for this particular application, and now I want to create a fully automated coded UI test. So let's create our first coded UI test. I'll say file, new project. And when you create a coded UI test, you can do so in either C# or Visual Basic. And I'm just going to create a test project just like I would if I was creating unit tests, web tests, load tests. It's the same type of project there. In fact, here you see I have my unit test that comes up. I don't need unit tests, so I'll go ahead and delete that, and we'll add a new coded UI test. Now, when I create this coded UI test, it's going to give me a couple of options for how I want to go out and create that. I can either say cancel and start coding it by hand, or I can say I want to launch a recorder so that I can click through my application, I can type some stuff, and it'll capture everything I'm doing behind the scenes. Or I can convert a manual test from Microsoft Test Manager, where a manual tester has created an action recording and then handed that off to the developers. We'll do that one later. For now, let me just show you what you get as the basic harness for a coded UI test. If you've written unit tests with Visual Studio using our MS Test framework, then this should look very, very similar. In fact, it's very similar to even an in-unit test or some of the other unit testing frameworks you're familiar with. Here I have just the markup is, coded UI test. Here's where all of my logic for my test is actually going to go, so we'll record something there later. And then as I scroll down, you can see that I have things like cleanup and initialize logic. So if I needed to populate a database with some sample data, or after I was done with my test, I wanted to clean up that database, then you could insert that in here just like you would for any other test type. So now let's drop into my main coded UI test method. And I'm going to get back to that option to generate code using the recorder. So you can go to test, generate code, and then use the coded UI test builder. And at this point, you'll get this doodad in the corner that allows you to start recording your actions. So the first button here is just a record button. I'm going to click that, and everything that we do from that point forward will be captured. The next one over is a crosshair that we can use to locate controls and add those to what's called a UI map that we'll work with later. And the UI map can then be used to validate those controls as well. So you can either activate those controls, like I'm clicking on a button, or you can say, does this label match this particular value? And then finally, the last button there is just to generate code once you're ready to spit that back into your file. So I'll say record. I'll launch my WPF application. Hello, Netherlands. Click on go. Close my application. And then generate that code. It's going to ask me for the name of the test method. We'll call it test application. Add and generate. So what that did is it just took the actions that I performed. It's actually working against the accessibility layer within Windows, so that's why we're able to actually detect what the user did. It took those actions and it generated some code from that. But before it generated the code, it also did an analysis pass against those actions that I performed, and it tried to condense some of those actions that I performed into the origin of my intent. And what do I mean by that? Well, what you saw me do was I went to the desktop and I double-clicked a shortcut that was on the desktop, and that in turn called an exe behind the scenes. Now that's great for my test machine, for my developer machine, but if I then deploy this out to a lab somewhere, or if I delete that shortcut on the desktop, then I don't want my test to break. So one of the things that our framework does is it tries to look at what you're actually trying to do, and it creates an action that maps to that. So for example, it doesn't care that I had a shortcut on the desktop. It just tries to launch that application by going straight to the executable. The other nice thing that we do here is we use multiple paths as fallback mechanisms in case that application can't be found at the original path that you gave it. And so here you can see that I'm calling in this application window exe path, and then I also have this alternate path. So let me show you what those look like. If I go to definition again, we actually have another class further down in this UI map file, which is where we're storing all of those values. And so here you can see the exe path, and that's pointing straight to the path where my application exists today. And then we actually notice that this is stored within a relative path based on this environment variable. And so we store that as well. And so that means if I move my Visual Studio project directory sometime later and we can't find it using the original executable path, we'll fall back to the other path. So that's a really nice thing. And you'll find that throughout the framework as you start using generating your own tests, as we try to do that whenever we can, just to make your tests a little bit more robust. Now, the other thing that you'll notice here is that we have some points, some XY coordinates that are showing up. And whenever people first start getting into coded UI tests, usually the first thing that they think is that we're finding controls on the form by using the XY coordinates. And of course, the next question I get is, well, what happens if I resize my application, I change the resolution, I move a button around, aren't my tests going to break? And the answer is no. The reason is that we actually don't use those XY coordinates to find the controls on the form. So the next question is, well, what do we actually use those XY coordinates for? And what we do is we actually record the position within a control that you performed a click operation. So if I go back to this application, when I clicked go, I clicked somewhere maybe 15 pixels over and 21 pixels down, and we recorded that, and we'll use that to actually play back subsequent actions. Now, for a simple button like this, it doesn't matter. We could click anywhere and it would basically do the same thing. But if you're familiar with a control like this down here, I think this is called a split button control, the location that I actually click this control actually makes a big difference. I can either shut down my computer or I can pull out this slide-out menu. And so that's when it becomes important to actually click somewhere relative within that particular control. And so then people say, well, what happens if I totally resize my control and that position no longer exists? There's actually some fallback mechanisms that we have to try to click somewhere relative to the size of the button that you clicked when you first recorded the application. But for the most part, you don't need to worry about XY, and that means that you can move around your controls, you can resize your controls, and the framework will just look for those controls using other mechanisms. And I'll talk about what those mechanisms are in just a moment. Okay. So that's a little bit about what's going on behind the scenes in code. Now, I mentioned that we also have this graphical editor that we added in Feature Pack 2. So if you install Feature Pack 2, you'll get this nice graphical editor experience that you can use to actually go back and maintain the actions in your code over time. If you were to click on that without Feature Pack 2, it takes you to some really messy XML, and I don't recommend it. So definitely get Feature Pack 2. And over on the left-hand side, you'll see that this is the method that I recorded. It's called test application. And then these are sort of the pseudo-English commands as they were recorded, which correspond to what I did. And behind the scenes, that actually maps to the individual lines of code, which are in that test method that I was looking at just a moment ago. And I can come in here and I can delete these if I want to. So sometimes when I record this, I actually use the tab button to move from one control to another. And you may not always want those extraneous tab controls. In fact, we don't need the tab controls in order to find the controls that are on our form. And so if your application later on added functionality that said, as we're changing focus from control to control, I want to do something else, then your tabbing may actually cause the test to fail because you don't actually want to tab into those controls and have them take focus. So I always suggest, as a first step, come in here and actually clean up those actions and delete extraneous tabs and anything that's not really required to make your test work. Here, this is a pretty clean record, so I'll keep it as it is. The other thing you'll notice over on the right-hand side is that we have some of those controls that have been added to my UI control map. Now, this starts with the top-level window. So here you can see a UI My WPF application window. So that's the top-level window that all of my controls live under. And then below that, we have things like the Go button. So the Go button, I promised you I would tell you how we actually find controls. If you look at these search properties down here, the search properties are what we use to start with whenever we're looking for a control. Now, that could be a Go button, it could be a text box, it could be a label. And for rich client applications, it's pretty easy because the rich client frameworks you use dictate that your controls have to have unique names within the application that you're developing. And so it makes it pretty easy for us to find those controls by basically just looking for controls that are of a certain type and meet a certain name. And that's as far as we need to go to find the unique control for that particular form. The problem with that, of course, is for web applications, we don't have the same level of rigor in terms of naming controls. I can have a text box that doesn't have a name. I could have a table or table rows that don't have names. And so that's why we actually have a different approach for web applications than we do for rich client applications. On the web, what we do is we start with the search properties, and these get applied using an AND structure. So we might look for every control on the form, which is a button. And then from there, we use what are called filter properties to try to narrow down the list of controls until we find exactly one match. And so on a web application, if we apply our search properties and we find five matches, and then we apply our first filter property, and that takes us down to three. And we apply another search filter property, and that takes us down to one. Then we know that's our control. If it takes us down to two and we don't have any more filter properties, then that's going to result in a failed test. So we weren't able to determine which control you're actually looking for. If it takes us down to zero, then that's also a failed test. And so as you start understanding your applications and figuring out which types of tests you need to generate, there's two ways that you can improve the robustness of your web applications. Number one is to make sure that whenever possible, you're giving those controls names. And that may mean going back and talking to the web developers who are generating the HTML and explaining to them why you need to give names to these controls so that you can make them more testable and maintain your tests over time. The other thing you can do is hand tweak those search properties. So I can come in here and I can apply new search properties. I can change the filter properties, change the order of those filter properties based on what I know about the type of application that's being developed. Okay. So I have some links in here that will actually take you to another blog post later on as additional reading so that you can learn in more detail exactly how search and filter works, because it's really important for web applications to understand that. But for now, just understand that that's how we're looking for controls, as we first search for the breadth of controls, and then we narrow that based on filters if you're doing a web application. Another thing that's interesting about these properties for individual actions is that you have things like continue on error. And so by default, every continue on error is set to false, meaning that if we can't click this button or we can't type this value into this text box, then we're going to go ahead and throw an error, and that's going to be the end of your test. Now, occasionally, you may have things that only fire once in a while. And a good example of that is, maybe you're surfing a website and every 100th visitor, it pops up and says, hey, do you want to complete this survey? I don't know about you, but every time I go to MSDN, I'm asked to complete a survey. It just seems to happen to me all the time. I see a lot of head nods. It seems like we need to filter that algorithm a little bit better. But in those cases, you may want to have some conditional logic in there that says, hey, if you see this control, click yes or click no or whatever. But if you don't see that, just go on to the next action. In that case, that's a good example where you would want to change continue on error to true. Another good example is if you are recording a test in a web application and your browser keeps popping up and saying, hey, do you want Internet Explorer to remember, your choice next time, right, or remember your form? Then, again, that's something that you may say no and never ask me again on your computer, but then when you deploy that test out to the lab environment, then you can't always be sure that those machines have been properly set up to actually disable that. So that's another good example where you'd want to record that action as saying no, and then come back in here and say continue on error equals yes. And then finally, the other thing you can do here is you can insert artificial delays. So I can say insert a delay before this particular action and say wait X number of seconds. Most of the time, you don't need to do that. Most of the time, our coded UI test framework is I guess smart enough would be the right word, to actually know when your controls are ready or know when your form is ready. So we watch the UI worker thread. If you're using a data grid and you're connecting that and data binding that back to some data source and you're retrieving data actively to populate that particular data grid, we're going to wait for that to finish before we try to validate the 15th row is equal to some value. Occasionally, though, your application may fire off asynchronous events every 10 seconds to go out and automatically refresh this data. Or it may you may be using some third-party controls that we're not familiar with, and so we can't always understand that those are going to go out and fetch more data or update their position. And so in those cases, you may want to insert artificial delays so that you're waiting a certain period of time before testing the application. So it's pretty straightforward to do that in here. I'll delete that action. Now, before I get too much further ahead of myself, let me just make sure that this test runs. Red, green, refactor, right? And sure enough, that test passed. So, pretty easy test. We're not doing anything fancy yet. In fact, we're not even validating whether or not that label has the right value. So we'll get to that. The first thing I want to do before I get into any sort of validation, though, is actually refactor this a little bit. So one thing I can do is I can say split this into a new method, and then split this into a new method. And now what we've done is we've effectively created three different parts to this method. So we have launch app, test app, and close app. I'm being really creative today. And basically, the reason I'm doing this is I can then later on come back and maybe I want to create an additional loop that says I want to actually input this data into the text box multiple times before I actually get to the point of closing my application. There's another reason that we're doing this as well, which has to do with what happens if a test fails and it doesn't properly get to the point that it can close the application. So I'll show you how to deal with that in a moment. Now, the pop-up that kept coming up was telling me that I have to now go back and manually change this so that it's calling the right actions in the right order. Okay. The other thing to point out while I'm doing this is that these are always listed in alphabetical order, not in necessarily in the order that you're calling them. So that sometimes trips people up as well. So just the fact that I've got close app, then launch app, then test app, that's why those come up the way they do. Okay? So let's go ahead and add some validation logic. Now, I'm going to validate after I've typed text into the text box and clicked go. So I just want to place my mouse cursor right after test app, and I'll say test, generate code, use coded UI test builder. So this, in addition to being able to generate actions, you can also use this to generate new code as well. And I'll use my cursor to drag and drop onto hello NL. And then you see a property bag down here that I can actually validate against any number of things. So I could validate to make sure that this text is black and that it's visible and that it's a certain size. Any number of things you want to validate against. Here, I'm just going to pick one of these, which is we want to pick the display text, say add assertion, make sure that that's equal, and validate that label. So now if I run my application again, make sure that it still works. Okay. So we haven't actually proven that we're testing anything yet because I haven't actually caused it to go red, right? I haven't actually caused a failure. So let's do that now. And the way I'll do that is I'll actually override one of the parameters within test app that is being used to input the data. And so here if I type this.ui map, you'll see that we have that other class, which is actually those parameters that we're using. Actually, I don't want launch app params, I want test app params. And what I can do is actually just go ahead and override the value that we're typing into that text box. So I'll override that to goodbye NL. And so now we've basically proven that this fails, because if I go into this test, you can see here that instead of getting hello NL, we were expecting, or instead of getting goodbye NL, we were actually expecting hello NL. So we know that that test is written correctly. Now, one of the things I like to do is come back into my assertions and make them more readable for the tester. Because you can imagine if you write a suite of 100 coded UI tests and you run these overnight, some poor tester is going to have to look at those in the morning and make sense of, okay, you know, these 15 failed, but what's actually failing, right? And if all they see is actual didn't equal to expected, they really don't have much context to understand what's going on. Is this a failed test because it's a false positive, or do we actually have an application error? And so one of the things you can do is come into that validation logic. And there's just a really simple override you can take advantage of on your assertion. So this is my assertion statement. And I'll say text box input did not match label output. Now this is a really basic example. In reality, yours would probably say something like sales tax plus subtotal didn't add up to, you know, the grand total on this particular form. And so now if we run this again, and we get this error, then it's a little bit friendlier for us. Because now in the test output, which would then roll up to the build output and the build report that you get each morning, then we actually get a little bit more information to help the tester out. Okay. Now, one of the things you may have noticed as I've been going through here and my tests have been failing is that I've actually got this extra baggage at the bottom of my taskbar, and that is that we didn't actually close out those applications. Now, for my simple WPF application with, you know, virtually no memory footprint, that's not a problem. I could probably get a few thousand of these running. But if you can imagine a more complex application on a build machine where you're having lots and lots of tests fire and lots of failures eventually, then you start to have problems with tests, especially if your application is not multi-tenant, and especially if your application's footprint is big, so you start running out of memory on the machine. So what we want to make sure is that this is a little bit more robust so that it automatically closes out of the application once we're finished, regardless of whether or not it passed or failed. Now, there's multiple ways to approach this. One way is to go into that test cleanup logic that's actually just in the stubbed out class at the bottom and make sure that you're calling anything that you need to clean up that application when you're done. Another way to do that is to take advantage of the using clause. Well, let me show you how that works. So if I go to definition for where we're launching this application, and just highlight where we're launching this from, if you're not familiar with using, it basically means that anytime this goes out of scope, then it's going to go ahead and dispose of this particular object. So I just need to scope it since it's in that UI map class. And because we're going to be launching this now ourselves, we can comment these guys out. Now, there's a temptation to want to go out and just delete the launch app method, go into the code and clean up that action. I would suggest that you don't do that. And the reason for that is because your parameters would then get deleted as well. So where that exe path is, that would actually get deleted if we were to delete the method out of our UI map file. And so just keep it in there. You can of course delete it from the test harness itself. So I can delete it from here. But don't delete it from the UI map file itself. I've made that mistake before. So now if we run this again, should do the exact same thing, except when this test fails, it automatically closes the application. So it did that for us. Now, of course, if we were doing something fancy like creating some database tables and then we wanted to destroy those, that's a really good opportunity to use the cleanup logic as opposed to just using the using clause, because of course once it goes out of context, it's not going to fire any more code. If it failed on that particular assertion, it's going to stop running it at that particular time. So if you need to do some cleanup, just add that in the cleanup script. So this test is okay, but I might have multiple values that I want to test. You know, goodbye in L. Maybe I want to type, you know, some longer strings and see how it behaves if I type some Unicode characters in here. And so rather than create this test 10 different times for 10 different inputs, I would suggest taking advantage of data binding. And if you've done data binding with unit tests, it's actually the same type of data binding here with coded UI tests. That's one of the advantages of us being on the same testing framework. And to take advantage of data binding, you can just come over to the test view window. And from test view, you highlight the test you're interested in. In this case, I just have one test. And then if you scroll up to data connection string and click on the ellipsis, you can point this at a CSV file or a database or an XML file. And in my example, I've actually already created one, so we'll show you what that looks like. Really simple, two columns labeled as input and output, and then we have some different data that we want to test this with and compare it to. It's going to ask me if I want to add this as a deployment item to my project. I suggest you do that because then you can version your XML file or your CSV file along with your project as that changes over time and you check it into source control. And this actually did a couple things for me. Most important is that it added this data source binding up here at the top. So you can see here that we're using a CSV as our data source. There's the path to the file, and we're going through here and we're doing a sequential data access method. You could also do things like random data access method so that you could test what happens if you order your tests in a different manner. That sometimes can cause some bugs that are useful for you to understand. We'll just keep it the way it is. The other thing we need to do is we need to manually bind the parameters we're looking for. So here, instead of using an exact string, I'll just say test context, data row, input. And then before I validate, I'm missing a two string. And so basically, as it goes through this test harness, the next time it's going to run it three times, once for each data row. And if we make changes to that, then of course it will run it X number of times for every row you have. Okay, so that's a little bit more interesting. Let me just show you one thing that can sometimes trick people up. If you change this file, like if I come down here and say I'm going to change the coded UI test parameters, so instead of saying hello world, I'm going to say goodbye world, save that. If you run it again right now, it's actually not going to take advantage of your changes. The reason for that is it actually hasn't been redeployed. In order for you to redeploy it to your solution folder, you have to build that solution, and then it redeploys that particular file. So don't go crazy staring at the screen wondering why it's not taking your changes. Just go ahead and rebuild that solution, and then it will deploy that out for you. Now, for those of you that have been paying close attention, you may have noticed that even though this is technically right, the text box value matches the label value that I was looking for. The problem is that the label actually was too big, right? And so that illustrates an important concept with automated testing. Oftentimes, we write automated tests that go out and do exactly what they say they should do, but at the end of the day, there's really no substitute for a human being looking at the test or looking at the result of the test and really understanding, is this the right UI that we want? I mean, you could write tests all day long to say, okay, you know, based on the input and the size of the label, is this going to fit, right? But that's not really going to pay off in the long run. Sometimes you just need somebody that's going to quickly look at all the tests and understand, you know, is this kind of semantically correct? Is this what the user would expect? And so one of the things you can do to achieve this is you can actually take snapshots along the way, and then you can save those snapshots either to the test results, or sometimes what I've seen people do is they take those snapshots and they save them to like a Word file, and then you can have a business analyst or really anyone who's familiar with the application sit through once a week, look through the Word file, say, okay, I know what should be happening, and yes, this UI looks good, or no, we need to reformat some things because once you get a text string that's longer than 30 characters, it starts to flood off the screen, right? And to do that is actually really, really simple. What I can do is come into, right before I validate the test, and I'll say image, going back to that UI map again. At this point, I want to find that top level control that I'm working on. And that top level control here is my WPF application window. Now, you can also capture the entire desktop if you want to. In this case, I'm just going to scope my screenshot down to the specific region of the application that I'm running with. So I'll say capture image. And then we'll just save that. Yes. Yes, the question was, can you capture a particular control? And yes, you could. If I fed it that button, for example, and just said, show me the button, it wouldn't be too interesting, but yes, you could certainly do that. And in fact, we could capture that label if we wanted to. That might be a little bit more interesting for us. Yeah. So yeah, good question. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Can you capture the image and compare it to another image? Yes, you can. I'm not going to show you that today, but I have a link to a blog post that tells you exactly how to do that. So if you know, for example, that a table needs to look the right way, or that a logo needs to appear on every screen, and that has to be formatted alongside another logo, then yes, you can do image comparisons with our framework, and that's relatively straightforward to do. So yeah, great question. So, here what I'm doing is just testcontext.addResult file. That test context actually has a lot of really interesting methods on it. So being able to add a result file means that after I run this test and drill into my test results, anything that I pass to it is going to be saved automatically. And you can get really creative there. Like sometimes what I'll do is I'll actually take a log file that may be just part of a regular output that comes from my application and save that to the test result as well. You never know when you're going to need something like that. If you're familiar with our overall testing framework in Visual Studio 2010, you can also use what are called data diagnostic adapters to capture all sorts of things while tests are being run. A good example would be system information. So show me, is this machine 32-bit, 64-bit, what service pack level, browser level, how much memory do I have? Another one would be a full video recording. Here I'm just capturing individual images, but you can capture an entire video recording if you want to. You can also capture things like IntelliTrace files. So if you're building a .NET application, you can capture an IntelliTrace file, which is kind of like a VCR for your code. So you can go back in time and show me which events happened. Did I write to a file, read from a file? Did I write to the registry, read from the registry? All of those things can be configured in your test settings from within Visual Studio, just by editing your existing test settings. And if you come to data and diagnostics, it all gets configured down here. So if I wanted to turn on, you know, test impact analysis, IntelliTrace, event logs, you can even scope the event log to only show me the security events. You know, anything that's going to be important for you as a developer when you get a bug back from this application to actually understand and resolve that issue, I suggest turning that stuff on. It could become really interesting as you get these bug reports back. But right now, I think I'm just about done. Let me just fix my test here. Okay, so my test passed. But if I then do a visual inspection You can see here that I have these collected files down at the bottom. Now, obviously, you'd give them a better naming convention. Maybe you want to actually name them based on the string you're passing in. That would have been a smart idea. But if we take a look at this particular file, you can see, yep, that looks great. But then if we get over to this particular file, you can see that it actually starts to run off the screen, and then this file as well. And so now what I might do is I might come in here and actually create a work item straight from this test result. I'll create a bug. And what this is going to do is it's going to ask my permission to actually publish all the test results back to Team Foundation Server. And we'll say yes. And of course, we can fill out that bug information, and we automatically get our attachments down here. If I turned on some of those additional data diagnostic adapters for collecting IntelliTrace, video recording system information, all that stuff would just populate automatically as a result of running this test. So it's a really nice way to make sure that you have the information you need to fix that bug. So I think that's actually all I wanted to show you. Oh, one more thing. You'll notice that some of the controls that we generate, or some of the methods that we generate when you're recording your tests, they actually get named based on the name of the control. And a lot of people are tempted to actually refactor this as their application changes and evolves over time. My advice there is don't bother changing the name of these controls. It's not going to, you know, really make those of us that like to have great names for everything happy, because some of these names are kind of kludgy and they stick with the tests over time. But the reality is, if you go in here and start trying to actually change all these names and refactor it throughout the application, or throughout the test, that is, there's not a lot of value in doing that. So I would say, you know, even though this says hello NL text display, and we may change it when we're actually changing that text later on, you know, unless you're really OCD, which I can be sometimes too, I would say just kind of leave that alone, because you're not going to get a lot of benefit from changing that. So let's recap a few of the best practices that I showed you here, and I'll talk about a couple that I'm not showing you today, but I have some links to provide you some more information. Get used to using, it's useful. I like saying that. So again, this is what you might use if you want to close your application automatically, even if the test fails. Understanding searching and filtering, and understanding that we actually don't use the XY coordinates to find those controls. A lot more information in this blog post if you want to check that out and understand what we do. Remember, filtering is only going to show up for the web applications. It's those searching that we use for all application types. Employee data binding, so take advantage of writing the test once and then feeding it different parameters, and maintain that list of parameters over time as you start to find edge cases. You know, maybe entering certain Unicode text into that text box is something we want to test for. So just update it in one place, and then all of your tests can use that. The other thing that you'll see in a minute is that data binding to manual test cases actually happens automatically for you if you go through the right workflow. So I'll show you how that comes together. Use friendlier assertions. Again, just use that override to give the tester a little bit more information when they're diagnosing the test failure. Take advantage of image captures as you're going through. Now, one thing that you'll notice is that our UI framework actually automatically captures an image if the test fails. That's actually a pretty buggy experience. I asked the developer for that, if you can actually turn it off or get a little bit more fine-grained control over when that is captured automatically if the test fails. And the answer is that you can't. And so for the next release, they're actually thinking about pulling that automatic capture out and just leaving it up to you as the user to decide when you want to capture those screenshots. But again, if you get into these a little bit further, you'll see that sometimes you get these automatic screenshots that keep showing up. There's not really a lot of control that you have over when those tests or when those screenshots are captured, unfortunately. And then here's the command to actually capture the entire desktop, is you actually just point the UI control at the desktop itself and say capture image. And to your question, if you pointed at a different control, you could capture that image of just that isolated control. So Microsoft Test Manager, as I mentioned, it provides a nice workflow if you wanted to take manual tests and actually elevate those to automated tests. In Team Foundation Server 2010, test cases are work items. And so as part of the test case work item, we actually give you a workflow that allows you to indicate that a certain manual test might be a good candidate for test automation. And so as part of your process of looking at your test debt and trying to figure out which ones you want to automate, a good thing to do is to actually go through and use that test automation field, and then you can query later and say, okay, which test cases do I have that I may want to create coded UI tests from. Now, when you create those coded UI tests, as I mentioned, you get a lot of really nice capabilities when you move from the manual testing experience into the coded UI testing experience, but there are some tricks that you want to take advantage of so that you get really good recordings that are going to be easier for you to use as coded UI tests and maintain over time. And I'll show you a quick example that illustrates that. To start with, I'm going to launch Microsoft Test Manager. This is our new tool built from the ground up specifically for manual testers. We didn't want to say, hey, you know, if you want to test with Visual Studio 2010, go install Visual Studio Ultimate and good luck with that 747 cockpit. So instead, this is really focused from the ground up to use terminology that testers use every day, like test cases and test plans and test suites. And I'm not going to show you a lot about this tool. I did a presentation last year if you want to go back and watch the recording of actually more of the ins and outs of how this tool works and what it can do for you. But for now, just understand that we have this test case, and this test case is all about making sure that we're entering, if the user enters invalid data in the shopping cart quantity, that it doesn't actually cause the shopping cart to freak out. Like if I type a -5 in there, we shouldn't be paying the user to actually shop from us. That would be a bad bug. And so here I have a list of all my test steps. Pretty straightforward until you get down to quantity. So here you can see that this quantity actually uses a Twitter symbol in front of it. I guess it's an ampersand, but it's not really a Twitter symbol, but you know what I mean. And down here at the bottom, you have parameter values that correspond to that. So I can actually maintain a table of parameter values within my manual test case, which then gets stored back in Team Foundation Server. So I don't have to maintain a separate database or CSV file to store those data-bound tests. So let's actually just run that test case, just like a manual tester might. And when I run this test case, I have the option of creating what's called an action recording. And an action recording is very, very similar to what you saw me do when I generated a recording of my WPF application. The only difference here is that it's not actually generating code behind the scenes. It's just storing everything in this pseudocode script that says I clicked on this button, I typed this text into this text box. And so I already have an existing action recording, so I'm just going to overwrite that one, which is something you might do after the application has changed and you want to generate a new flow through the application. And so from this point forward, anything that I do with my computer, with the exception of interacting with the test runner itself, is going to be captured and recorded. And the one thing to point out that I'm going to do here may seem a little bit laborious to mark each step as pass or fail, but the reason that I'm doing this will become clear later when we take a look at the coded UI test. And that is that the individual actions that I do for each test step will actually get created in their own test method for me. It makes it really easy to refactor and to maintain later on. Now, you don't have to do this every time you run a manual test. It's just really the main time you would do this is when you're getting ready to create a coded UI test from that. Here it's telling me that the first time I run this test case, it wants me to enter a quantity of A into this, so it actually already loads it in my clipboard, and I can just paste that in there. Now it's telling me to click somewhere in the white space, and that's going to refresh the form. And then it's telling the tester that they need to validate that that went back to 1. And so it did, so I'll pass that. And now actually just clean up my application. And so now as a manual tester, I can actually take advantage of this action recording that I created in subsequent test runs. So I can select, you know, the first 6 steps down to the point that it's asking me as a tester to validate something. I can click on play, go grab a cup of coffee, come back. My application now at that point will be ready for me to perform some action manually. Maybe the application's changing rapidly, so you don't actually want to record action recordings all of the time. Or maybe it just requires that the tester looks at something here. And sure enough, that value looks right to me. And then just for fun, I can... Oops. Play back the rest of these steps. And there's a third iteration, but I won't actually run that from the manual testing experience. Let's say that at this point, we're pretty happy with this test. The application has stabilized to the point that we think it's worth investing in test automation. So now I'll drop out of Microsoft Test Manager, pop back over into Visual Studio. If I was doing this the right way, I would have changed the test case to, say, planned automation status so that as a developer, I could query for that. Create a new testing project like we did last time. And this time when we add our coded UI test, I'm going to say that I want to use an existing action recording. So now that action recording gets stored in Team Foundation Server alongside that test case. Guess I haven't connected to TFS today. Wake up. There we go. And so from here, I could query for any test cases that have a planned automation status. I just happen to remember that's test case number 41. And so we'll pull that in, and that's going to generate code for me automatically based on that action recording and the individual test steps that those action recording steps corresponded to. So if we look down here, you can see that I have a method for each test step. And if I look behind the scenes, you can see exactly what it's doing. So here we're actually clicking on the fourth coffee flyer hyperlink. Okay. So now if I was to run this test right now, it would actually run through it three different times because it's automatically data bound back to those test parameters, which is pretty nice. If you look at this line here, we're actually already bound to that Team Foundation Server instance, to the test case individually 41. We're going through a data access method of sequential again. So if I went back to TFS and I updated those test parameters, it would automatically update for my particular test case, which is nice because then my testers themselves can actually maintain that list without having to drop into code and edit some CSV file somewhere. And then here you can see where we're actually passing the value for that given row into the UI quantity edit text box. Okay? The one thing we haven't done, of course, is we haven't replaced the manual tester looking at that value and validating that, yes, indeed, this is still equal to 1. So now I'll just add some validation logic in here by doing the same thing we did last time, generating code. I'll launch my web application and put it at the point in time that we know we want to validate. Drag and drop that validator. Now, sometimes when you're dragging and dropping that validator, it can become kind of difficult to get the exact control that you want. Sometimes your controls might not even be visible, like a panel that is just a container for multiple other controls. If that's the case and you want to validate against that panel or some other control that you can't drop it onto, just drop it on a control that's somewhere nearby, and then you can use this kind of D-pad over here to go up, down, left, right through the hierarchy. So it's just a nice way to find those controls you might be looking for. And so again, I have a list of all the different things I can validate against this. I'm just going to choose text and add that assertion. Validate quantity. Okay, so we're now validating that quantity. If we run that test, it should launch the browser 3 times for us. Any questions? Yeah?
You said that after adding some data to the
Yeah, sure.
What if we test to delete some records from database, and can we restore deleted items?
Sure, yeah. So the question is, what if the tester in the process of, are you talking about an automated test or a manual test? Okay, so what if in the process of running an automated test you delete records that you now want to get back? Well, you could invest in cleanup logic that actually goes back and re-adds those logic. That's one approach. The other thing you can do is you can wrap your entire test in a transaction so that at the end of your test you actually roll back the transaction. Not always something that's possible or a good approach, but that's another possibility. Another possibility there is to just restore the database, so before you run your test, take a snapshot of that database, and then restore it at the end. Let's see, I'm sure I'm missing some. Lab management is nice for this. So if you take advantage of our lab management solution, and I'm not showing that today, but you can set up a full build, deploy, test workflow so that you can say build, goes out and compiles the code, spins up one or more virtual environments, deploys your code into that virtual environment, and then you can have it snapshot those environments automatically for you before any of your tests are run. And that's really, really nice, especially if your tests do what you describe, which is they may muddy the database, they may, basically dirty your machine, so you want to go back to some given point in time. So not an easy approach, but there's lots of options. Yeah, sure. So the question is it possible to merge a unit test with a coded UI test, because then you could take advantage of mock object frameworks. And yeah, what you can do is you can use what's called an ordered test. And an ordered test is basically just a container of other tests that run in a specific order. And so you can say, fire off this unit test, fire off this coded UI test, maybe another coded UI test, and then finally clean up with another unit test that does something else to dispose of that mock object.
You don't need to think about the all deleted data. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. Yeah. I like that approach. Yep. Okay. Yeah.
I remember you saying in the beginning of the presentation that the framework itself is smart enough to wait for a control to respond, for example, when mm-hmm. it's gathering data from a data source or something like that.
Yep.
What if I would want to test if the control responds fast enough, if the performance is fast enough? Like, I
sure.
don't want the user to wait longer than 5 seconds, for example.
Yeah, that's a good question. So his question was, what if I want the test to fail if it takes too long for something to happen? And really, the only way to do that in our framework today is actually just to use your own timers. So you can start a timer before the application is launched, start another timer, or then look at that timer at the end and either record that and store it as part of the test result to say, hey, later on we want to look at this and see are we trending in the right direction. Or you could also just say if hard-coded it in the test and say if this takes longer than 5 seconds, then fail the test. In the future, there's a lot of things that are on our backlog to do in the next edition, and that may actually make it in where we're automatically doing some of that stuff for you. But right now, there's just the default overall test timeout, which I think by default is like 30 minutes or something. So that's not really going to give you a good bearing. You could make that much smaller, but if you have a long-running test which is doing a lot of things, then that's not going to give you an indication of is this specific part of UI responding correctly. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah. Good question. Okay. Now, let me just show you one more thing here, which is what if we wanted to test this in Firefox? So at this point, what I can do now that I have my test all set up, doesn't matter that I recorded this in IE. I can just say, run this back in Firefox. And there's actually one nuance here that I want to show you. This test is going to fail on the second iteration, and I'll show you why. You see it's running in Firefox here. Of course, you need to have Feature Pack 2 enabled to get this to work. This is really nice here because It's actually operating, as I said, at the DOM layer. So you'll want to test your code in multiple browsers, especially if you're taking advantage of client-side functionality. You know, if we were just testing something on the server side, then it wouldn't really matter. We could just run that in one browser. But if you're familiar with the type of test that you're running, then you can say, these particular tests, I want to test on multiple browsers. And so in this case, you're going to get this error that says that Firefox is already running because it tried to close Firefox, and then it tried to start the next test. But for whatever reason, Firefox takes a little bit longer to actually close than IE does. So in that case, there's actually a different approach you can take here, especially if you're doing multiple iterations of that particular test case. And so what you can do is, rather than calling close browser down here, you can actually point to your browser instance, which in this case is this not-so-friendly looking method here, our class there. And then you can say close. And that's actually a much better class to operate against if you're doing launch operations or go to this page operations or click on, you know, close out this browser operation, because it actually has familiarity with the underlying browser object itself, as opposed to just clicking on this particular X button and then going on to the next event there. So there you can see that that now works as we expect it to. I think it does. Yeah, there it does. Questions? Yeah?
Can't you just let the browser lit for the request? So you do it in your startup login, you start the browser and...
Yeah, so that's a good question. If you wanted to, you could just have the browser live for the entire request and then do multiple things while that browser instance is running. That's another approach you could take, sure. Yeah, that's a good one. By default, of course, if you take this over from the manual testing world, they're going to start the browser when they first start the test. So that's why all those actions exist in there like they do. And so it kind of assumes that you're closing out the browser at the end. So yeah. And of course, if you wrap the whole thing in a using clause, then of course would close out automatically each time. Over here, yeah. Are there any differences between premium and ultimate in what I'm showing? No. The only difference in what I've shown today is that when you install Visual Studio Ultimate, you also get the Microsoft Test Manager. So if you wanted to work with that flow and be able to bounce back and forth between manual testing and full-blown, you know, coded UI tests, then you'd be able to do that with Ultimate, but you can't do that with Premium. The other thing that I'm not showing today is that if you have Ultimate, then that gives you the license you need to work with lab management as a client. So with lab management, you could set up that full build, deploy, test workflow, and we could spin up those virtual environments. And with Ultimate, you get Microsoft Test Manager, which then also gives you the UI you need to connect back to your lab managed environment as well. So yeah, good question. Way in the back. Right. So the technique there is, what if you change the name of the control, or you change some other search property that we're looking for that control based on? And you're right. Depending on what you change, if you change something that is important for that particular search property, it could actually break your control. And so in that case, there's a few recommendations that I have. And actually, let me just hold that for 1 second, because I have a slide where I'll talk about that. Yeah. And actually, in the interest of time, let me switch over to the slides, and then if we have time at the end, we can get back to questions, and I'll stick around as well, of course. So that's the Microsoft Test Manager workflow. Continue on error we talked about. Again, this is things that may not happen every time, but you want to have the logic to advance the UI. So you can just set that equal to true, either by code or by going into the UI test map. Then Firefox, again, if you wanted to take advantage of Firefox with Feature Pack 2, I just showed you that one. There's the code. Some of this stuff is just so that you have the slide deck and you can refer to it later on back at home. Multiple UI map files. So this is kind of the be-all, end-all for creating coded UI tests that you may want to maintain, especially for really large applications, or when you have coded UI tests that multiple people will work on, so that you have multiple files they can access independently. And the types of applications I'm referring to are either either composite applications where you've got, you know, a broader application here that may have a complex set of controls, maybe a calendar control you're developing down here, and you want to maintain all of the test parameters that go along with understanding that composite control down here separately from your overall application where you're saying next, type this value and click finish, right? And so to do that, you can create multiple UI maps, one maybe that corresponds to each page of your application, one that corresponds to each complex composite control of your application, and you add those UI maps to your test project, and then you can access those independently. So when I'm calling into, you know, type this particular method, which is launching the application, that information may reside in one UI map file, call into this other method, which is calling to populate this grid with some shipping information, that may live in another UI map file. I'm not going to show you that today because there's an excellent blog post that goes step by step and shows you an example. If you find yourself in a situation where you want to create multiple UI maps, but it's something that most people I work with don't need that level of control. But if you really have highly scalable tests that you're creating, then that's an option for you. Getting back to this gentleman's question, how can you make your applications more testable? In my experience, this starts with communication. It starts with communicating to the people that are developing the application and having them talk to the people that are actually writing the code to test that application and helping to make sure that we all get on the same page and understand why, for example, it's important to come up with a good naming convention that we stick with throughout the application. You might like Hungarian, I might like Pascal. At the end of the day, let's just sort out our differences and come up with one naming convention, because you're right, depending on the type of application you're testing, you may find that if you change the control names, that actually causes your tests to start failing unexpectedly. The other thing, of course, is for web applications, when you're going to be testing those controls, make sure you give your controls names, especially the ones that are going to be part of those testing frameworks, because that's going to help us find those controls much more easily. And then, of course, educate your manual testers on coded UI tests as well. So that experience I showed you where as you're going through the manual test and you're recording that action recording, you're actually marking each test step as pass or fail. Explain to the testers why that's important so that as they come back and start handing things back to the development team, they understand how to do that in a way that's going to be most valuable to you. What about load testing? So if you've used load testing within our product, you know that you can take web tests, and web tests actually operate at the HTTP layer, and from a single machine, you can generate tens or hundreds or thousands of simulated virtual users hammering against a website or even an XML web service. And you can even create these to fire off unit tests as well. So you can have, you know, hundreds or thousands of unit tests running simultaneously, and you could even model different scenarios whereby 80% of your users are browsing your website, 10% are checking out, and 10% are creating a new account. It's a really cool technology. A lot of people ask, can I use that with coded UI tests? Yes, you can, but the caveat there is that a coded UI test assumes that it has full control over the mouse and keyboard. It's like if I moved away and someone else sat down and started driving my mouse and keyboard. And so what that means is if you want to simulate 50 users hitting your application and you want to use a coded UI test to do that, then you need to have 50 physical or virtual machines that are all running test agents and all hit that website at the same time or use that rich client application at the same time. The net of that is most of the time if you're doing this to test a web application, it's better to use web performance tests for that. But oftentimes you may find yourself in a situation where you want to create tests that simulate rich client applications, in which case you really have to use coded UI tests for that. Okay? And there's an MSDN article that explains more about that. Playback settings, you almost never need to touch the playback settings, but this gets into some of those timeouts we were talking about, where if you have a control that we know that the data grid is done painting, then we're going to actually start validating at that time. Well, if you go into the playback settings, you can actually change the way that works, and you can actually make this more or less aggressive just globally across your entire test. And so that's one thing that you can tweak, but most of the time you don't need to worry about that. If you're using an operating system other than Windows 7 or Windows Server 2008 R2, you'll want to download the latest accessibility pack for that. You may already have this from Windows Update already, but by doing this, this is going to give us much richer control over the accessibility events that get fired, which means that as you're recording and playing back those tests, it's going to give us a much better success rate. This is the scale-out test architecture. I'm not going to go into this because it's on my blog, but basically, if you wanted to scale this out across multiple virtual environments or multiple machines running simultaneously, we have a test agent, test controller architecture that you can use where the test controller actually farms this out to multiple machines and can run those tests and then collect the results, and you can analyze those. You can optionally publish those back to Team Foundation Server. And so I think I'm just about out of time. Hopefully you found this session valuable. I hope you'll take the time to fill out an evaluation. It's great to be back at Dev Days, and thanks for coming to the session.
Hi.
Hello. I could ask you a question.